everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror podcasting from the Horrid Halls of Academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we hope you got a really, really good night's sleep before you dive into this episode, just as we are about to dive into this episode and the next episode, because as we talked about last month, we're doing the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise.
I didn't sleep well last night.
No?
I'm nervous.
This is a big topic, and you guys have been really excited about it, which is great. That's what we want to see. We want to know that the stuff we're choosing to do is going to mean something to you, our very important and dear listeners. But there's been a lot of excitement about this one. So yeah, a little trepidatious. But
this franchise is huge. It is so near and dear to all of our hearts, and there's been a lot of ink spilled on it. There's so much out there already, but we're going to try and bring our own perspective into things. There's a lot to talk about. There's a lot to love, and I really loved revisiting these films. I don't know about you, but it had been a long time since I saw Nightmare on Elm Street, like the original Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, same. And, you know, I'd say out of, you know, what is generally considered the big three in horror, which is Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, and Halloween. Even though I love each of them, Nightmare on Elm Street may be my least favorite.
Wow, it is my top.
Is it your top?
Of those three,
and
for
sure. I really, really like these movies, but I love the sheer insanity of Halloween more. Just the bizarreness of it. I kind of gravitate more towards
those. That's funny, because it's the bizarreness of Nightmare on Elm Street that I love. It's the freedom, the creative freedom that is allowed in the use of dreams and like anything can happen. And those are absolutely my favorite horror films. Horror films where absolutely anything can happen. There are no rules in reality. You never know if it's dream or reality. Those are the movies that make me feel unsafe and the most immersive experiences, I think. No, we start these episodes where, like, what was your memory of the first time? I cannot remember the first time I saw Nightmare on Elm Street. It is so ubiquitous, and I must have been young, and I don't recall. I just loved it.
Now, did it scare you? Did it traumatize you? Or
I wouldn't say it traumatized. It definitely made an impression. It's so incredibly creative. And Freddy is, of course, super duper iconic. I think it's one of those movies where I saw most of the sequels over the course of my teenage years. And so they kind of bled together. And so revisiting them for this episode was kind of a good exercise in parsing them out and telling them apart and reflecting. But they really captured my imagination with regard to what horror is and what horror could be. And it shot Wes Craven way up my list for favorite horror directors.
Yeah, I mean, I think I probably saw Nightmare on Elm Street shortly after I saw Scream.
Oh, okay.
And that was kind of my big, big horror awakening in Scream, when I really fell in love, especially with slashers, and then kind of went back and started rewatching, or just watching for the first time, all of these films that are referenced in Scream, and then, of course, knowing that Wes Craven directed Nightmare on Elm Street. That was a big pull for me. And yeah, I remember renting all those fucking VHS videos, lugging them down the street and watching them in my bedroom. And then kind of catching up with the franchise a little bit around when Freddy vs. Jason came out. So I would have been in high school, very end of high school when that came out. And then when the remake came out in 2010, which was odd.
Oh, I wish you guys could see her face right now. She's making the perfect face. It's odd.
It was a weird experience. One that I didn't enjoy, just because I didn't enjoy the film. But I feel like more so than the films made an impression on me, their importance in the horror genre has really lasted with me, as well as the iconography of Freddy. He really not only transcended his place in these films, he went into a kind of pop culture mainstream form.
Big time.
And I think that's something we're going to talk a little bit more about in the next episode, when we get into the later sequels. But I think for the purity of the first one and then the kind of bizarre oddballness of the second one and the teamwork of the third one, these three films have something very special and very unique to offer.
Oh, yeah.
But I will say one thing that has always stuck with me from the first time I saw it, which would probably be when I was around 11 or 12, was Tina in the body bag.
Oh, my God.
It's still in rewatching it again, probably the fourth or fifth time I've seen it.
Oh, yeah.
It's just haunting.
Tina's death still fucks.
Yeah.
This film is so incredibly creative and, like, lo-fi, practical effects, so, so ambitious. We're going to get into its production history in a moment, but the more you dig into this film, the more you can't believe how important it is. And I think for us, you know, we were both kind of born around the same time. We weren't part of the crazy hype of going to wait in line and see it in the theaters and see that phenomenon emerge. We kind of grew up taking for granted that this was a very established, bona fide horror canon. So that's where we're coming at this from. But that's not to say that we didn't research the reception history thoroughly as per the Faculty of Horror. And yeah, I'm ready to get into it. Are you?
Yeah, let's fucking do it. This is 1984, Wes Craven's A Nightmare on Elm Street.
The kids of Elm Street don't know it yet, but something is coming to get them.
There's something out there, isn't there?
We just see cuts happen.
What did that, Lieutenant?
I don't know.
Tina!
Is the coroner got to say?
In the jar and puking since he saw it.
You're gonna kill me for sure.
Did you do it?
There was somebody else there.
He was locked in a room with a girl who went in alive and came out in a rubber bag.
No one knows where it came from or who it will visit next.
Nancy? There's something wrong with you. You're imagining things.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Do you believe in the boogeyman?
No.
Whatever you do, don't fall.
No!
She's the only one who can stop it. If she fails,
I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy.
No one will survive.
Help me, please!
Wes Craven, director of The Hills Have Eyes and Last House on the Left, a new masterpiece in fantasy terror, Nightmare on Elm Street.
In Springwood, Ohio, Nancy Thompson's friends are dying in their dreams. She and her friends feel a strange, menacing presence looming over them. Nancy confronts her mother, who reveals that she and other parents on their street, Elm Street, took justice into their own hands years ago and killed a local child murderer, Fred Krueger. She reveals that she kept Freddy's razor claw in their boiler. After Nancy manages to pull Freddy's hat out of a dream, and after all of her friends have died, she realizes that she must face Freddy and pull him out of the dream world. After grappling with him, she realizes that she can take away his power by turning her back on him. This seems to work until Freddy takes control of her dreams once more, turning them into nightmares. And you know this is part of my favorite saying.
What?
Well, you know, when something like really bugs you. And
oh,
like,
yes. You do know? Say this to me when just, something really bugs
just
me.
Just ignore it and turn it into a big old pile of 80s glitter. I realize that's kind of like a white feminist take on a lot of things. There's a lot of things you cannot turn your back
well,
on.
Well, not just that. It'll disappear into a pile of glitter until the next morning when it'll fuck you again.
Well, it sounds like some one-night stands.
Yes, it sounds like I'm talking about something else entirely. And perhaps this is a good springboard into our discussion of this film, was that ending wasn't the ending Wes Craven wanted.
Yeah.
He didn't want a franchise. He wanted Freddy to be vanquished, Nancy to be victorious, and all of that is wrapped up in this crazy New Line Cinema origin story, the origin story of a very prolific production company in horror. And so perhaps let's start there.
Yeah, and this is all to say that if you are interested in the production history of A Nightmare on Elm Street and you have not seen Never Sleep Again, the big Nightmare on Elm Street documentary, watch it. It's on Shudder.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, 4.5 hours.
At least.
Like that.
Feels like 10.
But they interview pretty much anyone they can get their hands on. And a lot of really honest conversations
mm-hmm.
happen within that film.
Mm-hmm.
Almost painfully honest at some points. But this all stemmed from the mind of one of the great horror auteurs, in my opinion, Wes Craven. And he had just come off of films such as Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, and he was looking for his next thing. He wasn't hugely famous, he wasn't hugely rich or successful, but he had a bit of time, and he was looking to write something new. Mm-hmm. And he was inspired by real life events that were occurring in Asia about these kids who were refusing to go to sleep. And then as soon as they went to sleep, they died. Mm-hmm.
He shopped the script around, and it was rejected and rejected and rejected. The major studios wanted nothing to do with this, and New Line Cinema, who had hitherto been more of a distribution company, they decided to give it a chance as their first movie that they actively produced. And so they put all their money into it, and it wasn't a small amount of money. This is something that I thought the Never Sleep Again documentary did a great job of portraying, that this film was not cheap. It was highly creative, and all of those practical effects took a lot of money and a lot of ingenuity, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. I don't think they mentioned it in the documentary, but I saw from another source that at one point they did run out of money, and there was a couple of weeks where they couldn't pay the crew. Mm-hmm. So this was very much a labor of love for everyone involved, and unfortunately Wes Craven had to kind of sign away his rights to this story and these characters in order to be able to afford to get it made. Something that, I don't know, I don't feel comfortable saying that it's a decision he would come to regret, because like I said, he didn't want a sequel, he didn't want involvement in the subsequent sequels until much later, so there's a bit of murky history in there, but suffice it to say that this film was a surprise smash hit that became a cultural phenomenon.
And I think there's something really interesting about Wes Craven, and he shares a kind of similar, in my mind anyway, sentimentality to someone like Stephen King. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of old-timey pastiche there where he really cares about his characters, mm-hmm. in a different way from Stephen King, but I think they share a little bit of DNA. But for me, when I watch a Wes Craven film, I see a director and a screenwriter who really cares about his protagonists. Mm-hmm. He's not laughing at them. He's not mocking them. He wants them to survive.
Yes.
And I think you feel that in A Nightmare on Elm Street in particular, because the deaths that happen are so traumatic.
Yeah.
They're so traumatic, and they hurt.
Uh-huh. And he knows how to get under our skin. He knows how to hurt us in that way. He's a very educated and bright man. He had undergrad degrees in English and psychology, master's degrees in philosophy and writing. He taught English at the college level, and that's when he started making films. And I think you can see it in Never Sleep Again. You can mm-hmm. see him talking about, you know, this motivation, and it has to be understood this way. This isn't one of those, you know, when we talk about George Romero films where it's like, ah, you know, all of this is in there. And George is like, I don't fucking know what you're talking about. Wes knew exactly what he was doing, and he did something really, really remarkable. And by the way, we did do a mini episode on Wes Craven at the time of his death in 2015. So I'll link to that in the course notes. And we do these kind of like little mini filmmaker spotlight, I think we called it.
Yeah.
We don't do those all the time, but we really wanted to give him some love because, you know, his approach to horror is really, it's kind of what Faculty of Horror is all about. I don't know if we'd be around if not for him.
Yeah, I think you need the creators who really care about their films.
Mm-hmm.
And you also need the creators who are a bit more lackadaisical about their films. Like, mm-hmm. We need that balance. But for me, Wes Craven is someone who's just factored really heavily into the films that I've loved and why I've loved them, and has kind of brought me through my horror fandom. And I actually found a really, really interesting interview with him from 1985, and it's from the Literature and Film Quarterly.
Oh, my.
I had to access it through JSTOR, which is like an academic paid thing,
yeah.
Like a search engine.
But almost. Free to access through your local library.
Should be. I know it is in Toronto.
Okay.
And hopefully your local library has a system that will allow you to access it, because it's a really, really interesting article. I posted a little bit about it in my Insta stories the other day and got some people reacting to it quite strongly.
Cool.
And it's an interview by an academic by the name of Christopher Charette. And the article is called Fairy Tales for the Apocalypse, Wes Craven on the Horror Film. And this was done in 1985. And Craven talks about how horror for him kind of operates as a social commentary on the malaise of a disrupted social contract after Watergate and Vietnam.
My.
And I was like, shit.
Okay.
Yup. And again, we have talked about the importance of Vietnam and the importance of Watergate, and I think we are experiencing this right now, definitely in the States with just Trump. We're going through it a little bit right now in Canada with Trudeau and the shit he's covering up right now. And so there's a general kind of upsetness that we can't trust the things that we are meant to trust. And the things that are supposed to be protecting us are probably not working in our best interest. And, you know, Craven talks in this interview about how his greatest influences aren't necessarily other films or filmmakers. They're actually his memories and his memories from childhood and of growing up, and how he kind of pulls these things in, and, you know, the merging of his actual memories with the feelings he was having at the time. He talks about the idea of hiding something so as to avoid showing weakness, which only creates a more monstrous weakness, a more obvious weakness, which I think is so central to the whole Elm Street franchise. And, you know, he talks about how the reality of the world at this time in the 80s, because again, this interview is 1985, was encroaching on the idea of the American dream and the American myth. So for more on that, you can revisit our Ravenous episode. But, you know, these things that were able to be denied and not talked about were now you had to talk about them. You had to talk about the issues happening in your street, the city around you, and the world around you. These are too important not to talk about. So they were all kind of influencing Craven and, you know, him wanting to explore the American dream as a kind of nightmare.
Right. So, like, the use of fairy tale in that paper title is really interesting to me, because something I was kind of grappling with in rewatching this film was, you know, Freddy Krueger almost had an element of an urban legend within the film's logic, within the film's universe. And I thought it was so interesting how Nancy is discovering who Freddy is and what happened to him and why he wants to kill people. And yet she had an awareness of that nursery rhyme. And the nursery rhyme not only names Freddy coming for you, better stay up late. Like, there are all these implications that there is almost a subconscious awareness of this boogeyman and who he is and what he wants. And yet it had kind of lost its meaning when it became just a nursery rhyme. And I think that's so interesting, because so many of our nursery rhymes nowadays have that seed of truth, have that something. We talk about this at length in our Urban Legends episode.
1, 2, Freddy's coming for you. 3, 4, then lock your door. 5, 6, grab the goose. 6, 7, 8, gonna stay up late. 9, 10, never sleep.
To talk a little bit more about this struggle between reality and fiction and how those two merge, I think it's important to enter in a topic that we've brought up before on the Faculty of Horror, and that would be from a fellow by the name of Robin Wood. He was a film critic, and he wrote a lot of really important critiques, really important film writer. And if you aren't familiar with him, there is a really great book called Robin Wood and the Horror Film.
Yes.
And it links together all his criticisms, and I actually learned about that in one of the last issues of Remorque.
You're welcome.
And I ordered it, and it did not disappoint.
Sweet.
And it includes this article, which is so, so seminal to contemporary North American horror films, and it's fittingly called Introduction to the American Horror Film by Robin Wood. And he has a lot of interesting things to say in this, but what I thought was most pertinent to the discussion of Nightmare on Elm Street is his notion that society is built on monogamy and the nuclear family, and that it represses a vast amount of sexual urges to maintain it. So you can't fuck anyone because you're married and you're mom and pop and you got your kids and you got to raise your kids, like that kind of thing. And in doing so, you kind of perpetrate these same beliefs and these same systems onto your children generation after generation. And to break free of those takes a lot of effort and a lot of consciousness.
Yes.
And horror films for Robin Wood were triggered by familial or sexual tensions. And the monster in any horror film is central, whether it's kind of a really overt monster like Freddy Krueger or a more esoteric one like the virus in Pontypool, let's say. So the monster is central, and it represents this repressed, forcing, characters to confront what they are denying.
Mm-hmm.
So generally pretty simple, but again, this notion of the repressed revisiting itself on generations is, that's basically the plot of Nightmare on Elm Street.
Basically, yeah. And it deals with that subject in such interesting ways. I feel like when it comes to Nancy and her friends, you know, they are at a point in their adolescence where they're going through puberty. So sexuality, as you said, is absolutely something that was being really repressed in the 80s. There was this whole backlash to the 60s and 70s and free love. There was the AIDS epidemic that was freaking everyone out. So not only do we have Nancy and her friends grappling with this repressed sexuality, we've got their parents repressing the truth. And, of course, that comes around to bite them to the point that the Elm Street parents are practically co-villains in this film, in the extent to which they hinder the survival of their kids.
And for me, this is one of the first slashers that actually kind of focuses on the parents
mm-hmm.
and their role within the film and the role within the narrative. You know, you've got a kind of really interesting later on kind of take on this in a film like Cherry Falls. But other than that, parents were largely absent. Or just kind of well-meaning, but again, they weren't around. So this one, the narrative core of this film has to do with parental figures.
Right. Like Friday the 13th, they're away at camp.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a chance for teenagers to go hog wild with their deepest desires, like unfettered by parental units. Whereas in Nightmare on Elm Street, parents feature prominently and problematically. We've got broken homes. We've got moms who are taking other lovers. We've got moms who are drinking. We've got dads who are kind of absent. And then we've got teenagers who are mitigating these factors, like in much the way that I did, you know, just sneaking around a little bit, a white lie here, a white lie there, you know, having to navigate those boundaries and negotiate those boundaries, especially when your parents are as problematic as Nancy's and mine.
Well, and one of the most interesting moments for me on the rewatch in regards to that was when Nancy's father uses her as bait
mm-hmm.
to catch Rod. Holy shit, that's a rough moment because her father is, of course, the lieutenant of the police force played by John Saxon. It's heartbreaking.
Right.
It's heartbreaking that they use her because she's trying to help her friend.
Uh-huh.
And it's not that she fully believes her friend or that she's totally sure that he didn't.
No, she harbors her doubts.
But it's horrible.
It's horrible and yet so perfectly fitting and so perfectly appropriate because this was the 80s parent at the time, right? It's like, I will protect you by any means necessary. And that again harkens back to their initial crime that started this whole thing. Basically, Freddy Krueger was able to get out of jail on a technicality and was walking the streets. And so the parents of Elm Street took the law into their own hands and executed him. And it's like, you know, justice by any means necessary and damn the consequences and look what happens. You know, I think that really points to the ways in which a lot of policy in the 80s were supposed to protect and help us out, but without a whole lot of foresight about whether or not that'll actually fuck us over.
Well, it's hard, I think, when you mandate protection and safety and things like that, because ostensibly they will be colored through any one political viewpoint.
Mm.
What is protection for one person is not protection for everyone else.
True that.
So, fuck you, Ronald Reagan.
Now, Ronald Reagan does feature into this with his, you know, I was reading kind of conflicting reports about how, about his stances on homosexuality.
Oh, yes.
He was definitely very pro-abstinence, anti-abortion, and this was, again, the backlash to the 60s and 70s that, you know, that didn't work out well for us. Now we've got AIDS and we've got all this trouble and we've got all this crisis. And so, you know, these kids who didn't grow up through those crises don't understand why. And these kids who don't know about Freddy Krueger and what their parents did, they don't understand why. And I think, you know, that ignorance and that repression really comes in strongly throughout this entire franchise. And I really think it's emblematic of the 80s, actually.
Well, and I think it's important to talk a little bit about Reagan and how he was elected. Because it informs so much of the kind of 80s conservative ideal. And it came about because Reagan was one of the first Republicans to actively side with and seek out the evangelical vote. And that is because he took a hard stance on abortion.
Mm-hmm.
So they started coming out in droves, in these big white conservative droves,
mm-hmm.
to vote for him.
Yeah.
And that is why the Republican Party has kind of maintained this allegiance to the Christian conservative.
That's right. And that manifested in so many ways, in like Geraldo and the Satanic Panic. That was like, it's a really big part of the 80s.
And another thing I thought that was very interesting rewatching this film is how bright it is, how colorful it is. Thankfully, it's a very popular film, so it's been like reissued and like color corrected, and so you've got these really beautiful copies of it to watch. But it's so sunny. There's this kind of beautiful like haze across, you know, 1428 Elm Street in Nancy's house. It's so idyllic that even in the kind of final moments of the film when Nancy's stepping out again into the sunshine, it's almost too perfect.
That's right.
Until you see, you know, the dummy of your mom gets set through a door.
That's right. And that's like another privilege that's afforded by virtue of like using dream logic. And like anything can happen at any time. You don't need to build atmosphere through nighttime and smoke when anything can happen at any given moment.
Another interesting topic to bring up at this point, because it kind of factors into the rest of the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise, is a paper by an author by the name of Pat Gill, and it's called The Monstrous Years, and it's about the degradation of the American family, or the American dream, so-called, what have you. And Gill references an author by the name of Mark Edmonston, who talks about how the Gothic tradition by the 80s was kind of falling apart, but it was still kind of alive, and that we weren't really sure what to be scared of anymore. So a notion of a monster like Freddy really places the fear in a very specific location, and it takes away the fear from what the parents are capable of.
Okay.
Like, holy shit, mom and dad, you murdered a man?
Yeah, yeah.
He was evil, sure, but you straight up
fucking
murdered him.
Burned him alive. Like,
with,
that's
like Rod and Stew from down the street? Like, holy shit. And this kind of redirect for Edmonston, this author, Mark Edmonston, it doesn't allow for transcendence for the characters.
Okay.
It doesn't allow them to change because they are kind of beholden to what their parents did for them. So it creates a stasis.
Right.
So the characters are kind of held. The ones that survive are held in this place. Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting to think about when you look at almost any horror franchise you can think of, is you get to the end and you defeat the monster and that's great, but oh no, there might be a stinger, or even if there isn't a stinger, there's probably another sequel coming. and so this kind of functionality of this like deus ex machina happening at the beginning of every new film that kind of re-triggers trauma, that re-triggers something. The Scream franchise is also highly culpable in this, which is, I mean, I wrote a little bit about in my book. But to get back to Pat Gill's paper, Gill wrote that the 1950s America, this is when they really began to move away what is good for community and society and what is best for the individual. This is, you know, we talked quite a lot about this in our American Psycho episode, but this is, you know, when you start to see that trend. For me, I related that to Nightmare on Elm Street because the children of Elm Street have a really hard time working together. They're all kind of hiding their own things, you know. Tina, when they all arrive at her house, she seems really upset and kind of freaked out. And she's really glad that, you know, Nancy and Glenn, her boyfriend, are there so they can hang out with her. But, you know, then when Rod shows up, she's all about him.
Yeah,
no,
she kind of abandons
fine.
Them.
We're just going to go, like, fuck in their bedroom. Everything's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
So they have a kind of lack of trust within themselves to, you know, move and work forward. So they don't actually have models for how to work together and how to function together. The only models they have, according to Gill, are these models from the happy families that they see on TV.
Yes.
From either reruns or TV shows like Happy Days or things like that. So they just try to model themselves on that. And I know that's something you've talked a lot about, Andrea, on this podcast.
I've definitely talked about how adolescence is a social construct. So here come the 80s, and the 80s really embraced adolescents being a very lucrative target market who have all this disposable income from babysitting and delivering pizza and stuff like that. But there were so many technological innovations in the 80s that kind of gave youth something to do and something to call their own. And I'm talking about the emergence of, you know, like video games, shopping malls, cable TV, MTV, VHS, materialism. This was like a boon to youth culture. So youth culture was very different at the time. And insofar as this was, you know, an exciting time for kids of the 80s to kind of like be recognized and see themselves in John Hughes films and stuff like that, it was also a time of crisis for their parents who were just like, no, we're just like Leave It to Beaver around here. And it's not. So there was just kind of this lie that they're living that I think we see manifested really strongly in this film.
Well, and I think what's important for the notion of dreams within this film is that dreams are very personal. I certainly have a hard time describing my dreams. Mm. And one of the interesting things is revisiting these films is I watched pretty much all of them with my partner. Mm-hmm. And he'd never seen them before, and he really enjoyed them. But I think they were also – they affected him a bit more because he suffers from sleep terrors.
Oh, shit.
Like a couple times a month he'll wake up screaming.
A couple of times a month?
Yeah, he'll wake up screaming.
That sucks.
Yeah.
It's happened to me twice in my life, and it's the worst.
And I think the notion of dreams within this time period, within this landscape, within this world of this film, mm-hmm. because Craven really, as I was saying, takes pains to create this idyllic Elm Street.
Yes.
And he talks about using the name Elm Street because every town in America has one. Elm Street was also the street that Kennedy was shot on.
Right.
Things like that. And, you know, when I was reading up a little bit about Craven to refresh myself, a couple different articles about him, especially around the time of his death, mentioned not only he was, you know, a filmmaker and a scholar, but also his interest in metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
So cut to me Googling what the fuck metaphysics is.
Okay.
It was a really Google fun us. Montage. So basically, metaphysics is a branch of philosophy that examines the relationship between mind and matter, possibility and actuality.
Okay.
And the general kind of basic questions that come up when you're talking about metaphysics is, what is there and what is it like?
Mm-hmm.
So that can be very helpful when you're describing a dream.
Sure.
You know, I was walking down my childhood street, but it was scary. It wasn't.
There's kind of a disconnect between what's happening and how it feels.
Exactly. So it's kind of playing with that notion. And I'm sure we have listeners out there who are much more adept at metaphysics than I am. So I think utilizing that notion gives that sense of individuality to these kids.
Mm-hmm.
They can't really live in each other's realities anymore mm-hmm. because Freddy is separating them via their dreams.
Mm-hmm.
They can't help them. Like, you can see that, I think, most particularly in Tina's death.
Mm-hmm.
And Rod wants to help her. He's freaking out. Like, who wouldn't? So I think Nightmare on Elm Street does away with this distinction between reality, dreams, and fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it internalizes and promotes a sense of truth that is personal.
Yeah.
And again, personal, it can be problematic because you're moving away from your friends who could help you, but it can be good because it's moving you away from the truth that your parents are telling you.
Right.
You're forging your own path forward.
So. Well, insofar as your dreams are personal, there are commonalities in dreams. And I think that's what's so fascinating. And I see that fascination in this film where they're like, you dreamt of that guy mm-hmm. too? It seems so implausible that two people, much less four, would be dreaming about the same guy in the same hat with a burned face and the claws and the sweater and the everything. And yet there are in existence kind of archetypal dreams that a lot of people tend to experience collectively, which is to say, I know that you and I have talked about our stress dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Which is to say the dreams that we experience under times of extreme stress. For me, it was like a really intense shift at a waitressing job where like I'm totally overwhelmed and there's too many tables and it's ridiculous. Like I had that job for a summer and that was like, my God, like 10 years ago now. It's insane. But it recurs and a lot of people have dreams about, you know, their teeth falling out, which is said to represent a lack of control, appearing naked or in their underwear, like in a humiliating, compromising position. So I think dreams are very personal, but there's also a lot that we don't understand about dreams. And so it remains a really fascinating subject. I tried to do some research. I tried to be able to like drop some truth bombs about dreams in this episode, but it's, you know, it's largely metaphysical.
Well, there is a theory that I think can help us dovetail a little bit into a discussion about Freddy himself, or Fred, as he is referred to within this film.
Right.
And
not so familiar this first time around.
No, he's not
buddy-buddy
yet.
Gotta get to
know
him a bit, yeah.
Mr. Krueger, if you're nasty. And this theory is one of the collective unconscious.
There it is.
A.K.A. objective psyche. And this was formulated by Carl Jung. And This notion is that the deepest parts of our subconscious are inherited and not built from personal experience. Mm-hmm. This theory posits that there are parts of ourselves, parts of our deepest mind, that reptilian brain, that are common to all people. Mm-hmm. They are not unique to us, and that they tend to come out in moments of great crisis.
Okay.
And that is, I think, for this film, where Freddy lives, in those moments of crisis and, mm-hmm. and fear and anxiety.
Yes, he definitely seems to feed upon fear, but he's amorphous. And that's part of what makes him so terrifying, because dreams are also amorphous. They're hard to bend our heads around. They're hard to remember, frankly, just by way of their existence. Another thing I came up with in looking into this film, and this is something that Wes Craven touches on so briefly again with Never Sleep Again, is a biblical reference about God, quotation marks, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children. Mm. And so there is kind of like a deep historical sense of stuff that your parents did sticks with you. It sticks with you in some way. And that's not just to say hereditary, that their deeds and their judgments and like that passes on. There are passages later in the Bible that kind of refute that attitude. And I imagine that its appearance in the Bible kind of has to do with the attitudes toward life and death at the time, which is to say, like, immortality is only achieved through your children and the passing along of the lineage. And, you know, like, for Jews at the time, there was a lot of anxiety about the continuation of their culture. And indeed, like, they have had to fight hard to still exist throughout history. So for persecuted people, keeping traditions alive is very important, lest their culture die off. And so in the case of Nightmare on Elm Street, there's this implication that the parents did what they did to protect their children, and yet they can't bend their heads around that action coming back to directly threaten their children. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so delicious, especially to see them cope with it with tremendous denial, escape through substance abuse and regression. And then you've got these kids fighting to face it head on. Yeah. And like you were saying before, you know, they kind of try to work together in that Nancy is kind of like, you have to keep watch, and I'm going to call you in on my dream or something. Nothing fucking works. But honestly, if Glenn had have stayed awake, there's some narrative holes in this film, and I didn't necessarily want to go there, but the assumption that he would be able to see that she was in distress, it's a little bit murky in this film at what point people wake up.
Yeah.
You know, we see her using a burn on her arm to wake her up in class, and yet when you look at Tina, you know, did those first slash wounds wake her up, or did she get dragged up to the ceiling and eviscerated for like 5 amazing minutes? Anyway, all this to say, we see a generation confronting the sins of their parents head on, whereas their parents kind of stuck their heads in the sand, which is something that we're going to get into in the next couple of movies, a theme that runs throughout this entire franchise and runs throughout that entire decade, I dare say.
Absolutely. And I mean, speaking of sticking your head in the sand, I'm sure most of our listeners probably know, this is pretty common knowledge, I think, at this point, was that Freddy started out as a child molester.
Still is, as far as I know.
But in the original film, they refer to him only as a child murderer.
That's right.
Only the remake actually kind of posits the notion of Freddy as pedophile.
Oh, I thought it came up in 3.
Not really.
Okay.
No. And that is because, and they talk again about it in the Never Sleep Again doc, is because of the McMartin trial. And again, the McMartin trial is something we talked about in our House of the Devil episode.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to that. About this kind of fear of children being molested and preyed upon sexually, which of course is a huge fear. And
fair enough.
Absolutely. I'm not debating that. So what New Line did is they asked Craven to change it to a child murderer, much more palatable. And they refer to Freddy as murdering up to 20 children on Elm Street.
Right.
Because it's apparently a long street.
I don't know.
And what's interesting about that, so the omission, and of course when you're kind of watching it, if you're coming into it new, my partner didn't know any of this, of course, Freddy's very sexual.
He is.
Very sexual. I mean, for me, the most sexual scene is the bathtub.
Yeah.
Maybe that's because I'm a bathtub lover.
There's the bathtub. There's the tongue. There's the I'm your boyfriend now.
Yep.
He is the most sexual of all the slasher villains. And not only because he's the only really verbal one compared to Michael Myers and Jason.
Yeah, I mean, Leatherface kind of goes for it a little bit, but
He does.
He's probably the closest, but he's like a far, far distant
right.
second.
I feel like Freddy really likes to taunt his victims in a sexually suggestive manner because it's creepy, because it's unsettling, and, like you said, because he was written as a pedophile, which they kind of omitted verbally in the film, but that feeling still persists that he's kind of perv.
And I think it's interesting because, again, as you were mentioning, Andrea, these kids are coming into their own through their adolescence.
Yes.
Which is something we're always trying to... You know, as we were all teens once, you're doing it, you're coming of age, and you're getting those urges.
Freud, sex,
hair
sex, sex.
Where you weren't having hair before. And I think the hardest thing to do as a teen, one of the hardest things to do as a teen, is foster a really healthy sexual relationship with yourself. And then eventually when you decide to engage a partner, if you do, to create a healthy, safe place for that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think especially for Nancy and Glenn, they seem to kind of be on a healthy track.
Mm-hmm.
So then to have this kind of figure come in and co-opt,
mm-hmm.
Particularly Nancy's sexuality, mm-hmm. is very, it's, I just found it so like disturbing and wrong and creepy, and it works for the film.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's everything that was feared at the time. And it's these parts of your brain that you can't control. Like if you're nodding off to sleep and you have like, I told you about a weird sex dream I had a couple weeks ago.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And oh boy, I'm still not over it. But there are these parts of your brain, these animal parts of your brain that you can't control. And then you have a weird sex dream about Fred Durst, and that's where your life is at.
It's okay if you love him. He's Fred Durst, eh?
You didn't do that like Get Naked song?
I do remember that. I remember the video, and I remember he was the only one who didn't get naked.
Yeah.
How do you compete with Tommy Lee's physique, am I right?
As we kind of wrap up the discussion of the first film, and I hesitate to say wrap up because I think a lot of the stuff we're talking about is going to come back, like the repressed, through the rest of these films. But what I did want to talk about, Andrea, is I kind of wanted to get your take on the final moment of the film, or the final scene of the film, because as you mentioned, Wes Craven had intended Nancy to kind of like walk off into the sunset, like head held high, doing good. But of course, New Line and Robert Shea wanted to leave it open for a sequel. So they needed a stinger. And they have Freddy's hood come up over the convertible that Glenn is driving. Nancy's mother gets sucked through the door window.
Kind of looks like my mom. Anyway, sorry. Yes.
So, but we've got that stinger. And it's an effective stinger for the kind of journey of the film.
Yeah.
I love a stinger. I can't help it. But my question to you is, how do you read the last scene of the film
in
terms of logic?
Oh, in terms of logic, I have bigger beefs than that stinger. Do you know what I mean? Like when it comes to when people wake up, at what point their dreaming is lucid, there's kind of like, you know, you're moving around in your dream and yet it only becomes the real world when you're actually thrashing with him. Like that booby traps in your house would apply to the dream. Like those are kind of the gripes I had.
Yeah.
And I went through those and I don't want to go there because I have not sorted them out. But if we're going to talk about the stinger, I feel like the stinger is perfectly rational logic that it was all a nightmare and the nightmare continues.
It's a good dream logic.
It is a good dream logic. It narratively, like, it looks good. Even if there wasn't a sequel, I would prefer that ending to a suddenly he just turned into a pile of glitter ending. I would have felt a bit ripped off if that was the case. All you gotta do is not be afraid. That's just a little too Barney for me.
I say that to you like every Wednesday.
I know. And every time you say it, I'm always like, yeah. And then I get in the car and everything's fucked, so whatever.
Johnny Depp's driving it.
Oh, shit. He can drive me nowhere.
I think for me, and there's so much conjecture about, like, what is the meaning of the film? What does that last scene mean?
Okay.
In terms of a kind of logic perspective.
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, is it just a continuation of Nancy's nightmare? Is she dead? Obviously she's not because she comes back later.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, what I kind of take away from that last scene is the power of Freddy. You know, because you've got this really interesting scene where Nancy takes back everything she's ever given him and, you know, he glitters away. And that last moment is heartbreaking more than it is chilling for me,
mm-hmm.
because he has been able to tap into her fantasy. Her fantasy that her mother is...
You wish your mom was still alive.
Well, it's like conscious.
Yeah. Sober.
Is taking care of her, is like aware of her, and that all of her friends are waiting for her. Mm-hmm. And they don't have this sad, traumatic life. They're all in this car and they're going to go to school and they're going to get good jobs and everything's going to be okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that power to tap into that and convert it is so chilling.
Yeah.
It's eerie.
It's chilling and it's real. Mm-hmm. Because when you're dealing with something like the return of the repressed, there is no nice solution. You have to cope with it. You don't vanquish it. You get by one way or the other.
Well, and it's very much the promise of the 80s. It's the Reagan promise of, you know what, we'll, you know, pray to God and we're going to have this beautiful life and everything is going to be great. But oh, shit, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, had it ended any other way. I respect that Wes, you know, wanted what he wanted. And, you know, Robert Shea, I do think that he sticks his nose into this franchise a little bit. Maybe fairly so. It is the house that Freddy built, but also, you're a fucking producer, so slow your roll. I do like his ending a lot better. Yeah. And I love a stinger. I love an unhappy ending. And especially one that's so ambiguous. You know, we don't actually know how many of those kids died. We don't know how much, we don't know to what extent that entire movie was a dream. And I think that just really fires the imagination. And it's a gimmick that, you know, we've seen 100,000 times since, you know, just kind of that weird, I've come to refer to it as the Fight Club gimmick, which maybe isn't fair because it certainly wasn't the first. Yeah. But I feel like it was kind of the most recent movie to really have that surprise you, mm-hmm. that it was him all along, mm-hmm. or that it was a dream all along. Like that has become an expected thing, but it's still effective after all these years in A Nightmare on Elm Street. In tackling this franchise, I mean, everything that we've talked about has just laid the foundation for themes that are just going to be built upon, and it's just building blocks. And I think that this is why Nightmare on Elm Street is such a strong franchise. It doesn't disconnect. Like, even though there are hits and misses within it, there's an interior logic, there's an interior continuity of these themes that is so satisfying to me. So if you're ready to move on, let's talk about Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge.
Someone is coming back to Elm Street. He is not friendly. He is not patient.
Get off of me!
And he is not a welcome visitor.
No! No! No!
But he has something terribly special for the new kid on the block.
It started to happen again.
Dad!
In trouble. You've had some scary dreams, okay? Help!
Daddy can't help you now.
There's something inside him.
I can't fight him! You're not afraid of him. He doesn't even exist.
Freddy Krueger is back on Elm Street.
Get out of here, Lisa!
Just fight him.
Watch out for him. We'll be in your neighborhood soon. A Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 2.
You are all my children now.
Freddy's Revenge.
From the onset, Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge has little to do with the first Nightmare film, except that teen Jesse Walsh has moved into Nancy Thompson's former home on Elm Street. He starts having nightmares and discovers Nancy's journal in his bedroom, where she writes about having nightmares that are very similar to his own. Strange things start occurring in his life, starting with fires, starting in his home, and eventually culminating in murder, such that Jesse begins to suspect that he is acting against his own free will. Sure enough, Freddy Krueger is possessing him, and along with his sort of girlfriend, Lisa, more on that later, he learns more about Freddy, and Lisa is able to break Freddy's spell by kissing him, enabling Jesse to fight back and expel Freddy from his body. Things seem to go back to normal, but as in the first film, an epilogue shows Jesse and his friends in a nightmare sequence where Freddy drives their school bus off a highway into the desert. Now that's my super brief synopsis, but anyone who knows anything about this film knows that it's the notoriously queer Nightmare on Elm Street sequel that was, I don't want to say reviled, even though it was reviled upon its release, box office smash success because everybody loved the original film so much. And this was in 1985. It was the very next year, the very next fall. Everybody was hungry for the Nightmare sequel and audiences just panned it. However, this film has had a recent reappreciation for its many queer themes. It's being celebrated and embraced now to the point where there is a new documentary that is currently touring festivals. You're going to hear a lot about it if you haven't already. It's called Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street. And this documentary follows Mark Patton's journey through Nightmare on Elm Street 2, how he got the role, what the role was like, the reception of the film, and how it impacted his career. And it's actually a very heart-wrenching story, but the documentary has a beautiful and satisfying narrative. I can't recommend this film enough. You're going to hear about it. You're going to want to go see it. You won't be sorry.
And mid-episode plug, it's actually going to be playing the same day we do our live show at Salem Horror Fest.
Yes.
And I think Mark Patton, who plays Jesse, is going to be in attendance.
I sure hope so, because God, what a guy. Yeah. He is a sweetheart. And, you know, he, insofar as this film really fucked up his life and his career, he's not bitter. The documentary really has, like I said, a really nice narrative arc where he kind of reconciles with it and reconciles with its creators, which is a big part of this film's story. And perhaps there's a feature in an upcoming Rue Morgue magazine. I don't
know.
Maybe. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, for so long, and I think still to this day, you will see Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, referred to as the gayest horror film ever made. You know, to the point when a very dear close friend of mine, when I was kind of getting him into horror and he was getting into horror via me, I was like his Freddy. He's gay. And, you know, we've been watching all these movies and he'd gone away and like been reading about horror movies. And he came back to me and he was like, I really, really want to watch Nightmare on Elm Street 2 because I hear it's the gayest horror film ever made. And we watched it and we had a really interesting conversation about it afterwards. And I think he felt a lot of similarities to what it was like to be kind of unsure of his sexuality when he was in high school. He had girlfriends in high school, all of this kind of stuff that is tackled within this film. And then eventually, you know, later on in his life came out as gay. I think this is, again, as we've talked about, and even some of the comments I've seen on our social media were like, ah, Nightmare on Elm Street 2 sucks.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, okay, it sucks for you, but it is hugely important to part of a community.
That's right.
I actually don't hate this film.
Not at all.
I think it's super fun. I think if you try to look at it as kind of a continuation of the mythology of Freddy Krueger, it'll kind of fall apart pretty quick. But as we at the Faculty of Horror like to say, audience reception is paramount. And this is such an interesting look at how an audience receives a film.
That's right.
And how, yes, it got its box office based off the strength of the first one, and then has kind of gone on to find its own cult audience, almost separate from the rest of the franchise. And I think, you know, it's important, and it's interesting, and it's funny, and it's weird, and I'm just very happy this film exists, and I'm so happy that Mark Patton made his documentary. I can't wait to see it. And is making peace with this film and, and his role in it.
Now, this is touched upon in the Never Sleep Again documentary that director Jack Sholder denied awareness of any gay subtext, which when you're watching this film again, you're kind of like, well, are you crazy? Like, were you not there? And yet I can remember seeing this film as a teenager when I'm digging into the franchise, when I'm kind of forming my bedrock of horror fandom, so to speak. I remember finding it odd. And like you said, it doesn't seem to fit in with the franchise in that it's a possession movie. It doesn't have the slasher tropes that we've come to recognize that the original Nightmare on Elm Street indeed helped create. So the Never Sleep Again documentary has many cast members being like, I don't know.
What?
It's kind of hard to watch and it's a head scratcher, but at the same time, I kind of get it. And what's interesting about this film is the writer, David Chaskin, who was a New Line employee and kind of got this gig, he wrote it as a possession story. And according to him, There was gay subtext that he was aware of, and in his mind, he was making an anti-homophobic film as opposed to a pro-homosexual film. And that's something that, to me, is just kind of like the way we talk about films with the Faculty of Horror, like, isn't an anti-sexist film a feminist one? Mm-hmm. You know, like, we've talked about movies that don't even engage in feminism per se, some movies like The Thing or Session 9 that don't even have strong female characters can be feminist in their negation of the patriarchy and patriarchal norms and stuff like that. So personally, my reading is that Chaskin, it's almost as though he had the balls to make a queer horror film well ahead of its time, but he didn't have the balls to own it. Mm-hmm. And it seems like he really pinned that on Mark. Now, on paper, this film was just kind of, you know, a possession story. And it seems like over the course of production and script rewrites and filming and some improvisation, they really leaned in to the queer films. And I buy that. I've spent a little bit of time on a film set, and I know that, like, things can change, things can shift. And so I think the vibe on the set of that film was probably very accepting and progressive, and yet you can't control how that film goes out into the wider world and what the wider world makes of that, especially in the context of the 1980s, where AIDS was a huge, huge anxiety, and the emergence of AIDS was terribly convenient for homophobic pundits to really problematize and criminalize homosexuality. And this was the context. And this was something that really fell to Mark Patton. He really took the heat for that. And that's what the Scream Queen documentary deals with, basically.
Yeah. And, you know, in doing research on this whole franchise, I stumbled across an article on the AV Club, which just kind of talked about the entire franchise of A Nightmare on Elm Street. Mm-hmm. Came out a couple of years ago, I think it was 2016, this article. And it's kind of like, I won't even link it because it's not that interesting. You can find it.
AV Club, suck on that.
You know, and I love the AV Club. they've been great to us. Seriously. They really have. I'm not shitting on the AV Club. But this article in particular, it was just very straightforward.
Okay.
But the one part where I had a total record scratch was when they were talking about Nightmare on Elm Street 2, mm-hmm. and they referred to it as a homophobic film.
A homophobic film?
Yes. And the reason was because it's associating being homosexual with being a monster.
Okay.
And a lot of people kind of came out in the comments and were like, you can't call this film homophobic. You know, I haven't read this film as homophobic, but I thought, you know, this may be some critique that some people have. It's definitely out there, mm-hmm. let's say. So I thought it would be a good opportunity to talk about queer monsters, or as a scholar by the name of Harry M. Benchoff refers to it as monster queers. And Benchoff identifies monster queers as the monster is to normality as homosexuality is to heterosexual. And this is from his article, or his book rather, Monster in the Closet, Homosexuality in the Horror Film. And, you know, I think it's an interesting way to look at it because, to use another example, let's say, it's kind of the same way when we talked about The Witch.
Okay.
That Thomason is only the villain if you believe so much in a puritanical Christian way of living.
Right. It depends on your standpoint.
And a lot of the articles that I pull from in my reading of this and just to kind of talk about it in a bit more fulsome way, there's a really great article on BuzzFeed, which we will link in the show notes. And the title is How Did a Bunch of Mythical Monsters Become Queer Icons? And it's by a writer by the name of John Paul Brammer. And he talks about this notion of a gay man seen as boogeyman. Mm-hmm. And he relates it to, you know, his small town America and how the boys in the locker room were so scared to be gay or to be seen as gay.
Right.
All of those things that
it's
kind
like
of
a locker room McCarthyism of the time.
Exactly. And there is this real fear about if you felt this way or if you protected someone who was, like, what does that mean about mm-hmm. you? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the queer monster, the queer villain is not something that is uncommon. A lot of us are indoctrinated with it when we're kids through the Disney villains, or as they refer to in different articles, the sissy quote-unquote villain. Mm-hmm. And you can see that in characters like Jafar, Ursula, Scar, all of those things. And there are different elements that are associated with being queer within those villains. Mm-hmm. But for the queer community, they reclaim these characters. Mm-hmm. And I think as allies, I certainly support the reclaiming of these characters because they are a threat to a kind of normalcy and a kind of hypocritical normalcy. Mm-hmm. You know, and Jesse's wrestling with his identity and his identity being kind of coerced by this monster Freddy plays in really heavily to it. And I think we've seen something really recently like this in the kind of the meme, let's say, of the internet sensation of the gay Babadook.
Yes.
That was, I guess, a year or two ago now.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Babadook came out, what, 2014, 2015? And then it got, like, misplaced on Netflix as an LGBTQ film. And then it just kind of took off as this meme. And then there were people showing up at Pride in the Babadook.
Yeah.
Bob the drag queen from Drag Race did an event where he dressed as the Babadook. And it was just like, there are these figures in our culture, in our society, that are going to fuck with your heteronormalcy.
That's right.
And we're just going to celebrate that, and we're going to be weird and awesome and cool, and you guys can just fucking deal with it.
That's right.
And I think there is something incredibly powerful about that, about reclaiming the words and things and the prejudices that are pushed against you and celebrating them. And again, as I said, reclaiming them. All of this is in order to make fun of a dominant culture.
That's right.
A dominant culture that represses. And isn't that what this franchise is about?
Isn't that satire, as we've typified it? It's not as complicated as, say, Sleepaway Camp that we've talked about in a previous episode, where it's so murky and you could read it this way, but then there's problems. And even if you read it this way, then there's problems. And there's problems and problems of agency and this and this and that. This film, I really can't think of a reading that's not embracing something that is coming out within you that maybe you don't understand, and so maybe you're scared of it. Like, this film is so lovely that way.
And I think, you know, there is, again, as we talked about in the first film, about these kids wrestling with their own sexuality and things like that, and Freddy being kind of this predator here. Freddy kind of acts as a kind of truth-sayer, pushing Jesse towards things that he might actually really want and really want to be around.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, people will say, well, you know, he's saved with the love of Lisa. But of course, the end, the stinger, Freddy's hand bursts through her vapid best friend's
right.
chest.
Yeah.
So the gay doesn't go away, guys.
No. And even I read that kiss as, like, you know, their relationship is so platonic. I almost read it as a kiss of acceptance, as mm-hmm. a kiss of support that's just kind of like, I still love you. You know what I mean? Like, oh, no matter what you are, no matter how much it breaks my heart that maybe you don't want to be with me in the way that I do, every time I watch this film, I feel like it's more subversive mm-hmm. than it gets credit for. But it's getting that credit now, so I guess I can't really say that anymore. Now, Wes Craven wanted, I'm not going to say that he wanted nothing to do with this film. He didn't want a sequel, and certainly Chaskin, and this is emblematic of the second film, and this is something that you posted a great link on the Faculty of Horror social media about how the third film in a franchise tends to go back to its roots and so on and so forth. I really want to link that in the show notes because I think it's such a great film, but I think it's such a great point, especially pertaining to this franchise. But the second film, they were trying to do something really different. And what they tried to do was make it a possession movie. And, you know, like slashers, possession movies often utilize women and girls as vessels for demons, presumably because it's more shocking for a pretty young woman to say, your mother sucks cocks in hell, than it is for a young man to spew that kind of profanity. It's more shocking. It's against what we've come to expect from women. And in tandem with that, we've got this final boy in a sequel to a film that really crystallized the final girl in Nancy Thompson. And, you know, when we talk about slashers, there's kind of the proto-slashers of Halloween and Psycho, where there's a final girl, but, you know, she is kind of saved by a man in the end. Nancy was the big exception to that, where she had all the agency. She really did it all herself. Like, the men in her life largely failed her and actually kind of fucked her over. He here we've got a film where they tried to subvert that by putting a boy in the place of the girl, and it did not work. And it didn't work for possession movie tropes, but it also didn't work even as a slasher movie. In Nightmare on Elm Street 2, like, Jesse is saved by his girlfriend, but also I think, and Carol Clover talks about this, final girls become masculinized in slasher movies. There's the phallic appropriation of adopting a phallic weapon, and that in order for that trope to be successful, the audience has to buy into the final girl's abject terror. And audiences have an easier time doing that with women than they do with men. And so as such, like, for Jesse to have been a normal masculine hetero boy was kind of doomed from the start, so to speak.
Yeah, and I mean, as we were talking about the possessed in film, when we talk about, again, generally the female possessed, their suffering is in order to redeem a male character.
That's
right. Something, biggest example, The Exorcist.
Yep.
It's not really about Reagan. It's about Karis.
That's right.
She is the vessel for this male character's absolution. Now, Barbara Creed, another scholar who we've mentioned on the podcast before, she talks about the monstrous feminine. And in a case like Nightmare on Elm Street 2, this is when the monstrous feminine becomes the monstrous masculine. And for Creed, this is when the male body becomes monstrous when it assumes characteristics associated with the female body. So the monstrous feminine, that's not a final girl. That's a Reagan. That's someone else. That's, you know, a site of horror. When the female body is a site of horror. And I don't think Creed is like, yeah, the male body is scary when it's ladylike. I don't think that's what she is saying. What she's saying is the perception is this.
Absolutely. And that, like, yeah, that just goes back to big P patriarchy. And that just goes back to sexism. And for a woman to adopt male characteristics, it's strong. It's subversive. For a male to adopt female characteristics is a step back. Mm-hmm. He's weak, and he's this, and he's that, and he's gay, and he's wrong. And that's kind of the rhetoric that came out of this film that's being rightfully questioned.
Yeah, and, you know, another article we can link in the show notes is another one from BuzzFeed where it kind of details Mark Patton's journey with this film, and it's called The Nightmare Behind the Gayest Horror Film Ever Made. Mm-hmm. So it's talking a bit about Scream Queen. I think this is about a year or so ago before it came out.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that Chaskin says in this article is that he wanted to tap into the fear of being gay, but also being the outsider, that panic and that worry. And I was recently just started listening to this podcast that the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company, is doing right now. And it's about the Bruce MacArthur trial. And Bruce MacArthur is, for anyone who doesn't know, he is Canada's most recent serial killer. Toronto's most recent serial killer. And he's gay, and he targeted gay men in the village.
Mm-hmm. There'll be movies, I've no doubt.
I'm sure. And the men in this podcast, they interview men who knew the victims, and they speak so openly and honestly about being scared when they were in their small towns or in their other countries or wherever they were, where they felt like they weren't accepted. Mm-hmm. And then when they came to the village, which is the queer scene in Toronto, which is around Church and Wellesley in the city, they felt acceptance and they felt openness and they felt that they could express who they were. Mm-hmm. And it stopped being scary.
And they got murdered.
Well, yeah. That's not the happiest example.
No, but it's really analogous to this movie where I think Mark Patton felt safe on that movie set. I think they were all having a lot of fun and probably having a lot of laughs. Like these scenes that we're talking about.
If you're not having fun.
Exactly. Or even the shower scene, or like, it's all so tongue in cheek and it seems so playful and so fun until you hear that, you know, this movie came out and it really impacted someone's life. It impacted it very negatively. And you can have a closed, safe space that once it enters the public sphere is not a safe space at all. And I think someone even said in the Nightmare on Elm Street documentary, Never Sleep Again, someone said something like, openly gay Mark Patton, just nobody knew about it yet. And I'm like, that's not what openly gay means. Mm-hmm. And outing someone before they're ready, when the circumstances aren't right, when the circumstances aren't safe, is doing serious, serious harm to a person. So it's wonderful to see him reclaim that story, to see this movie reclaimed by the community and being reappreciated for what it is. And it's an oddball, but it doesn't not fit in this franchise that is essentially about the anxieties of the 1980s. Fits like a knifed glove in that respect.
And I think another interesting thing to talk about in terms of this film that's not related to queer subtext is kind of stemming from Carol Clover's notion of the slasher and the elements that have to exist within a slasher. Mm-hmm. We've kind of chatted about the final girl slash final boy in this situation. And the other one I wanted to mention was Clover's notion of the terrible place.
Okay.
So terrible place for Clover would be something like Camp Crystal Lake. It could be the Myers home in Halloween. And that in Nightmare on Elm Street, what becomes established, especially through these three films, is that the terrible place is Nancy's home, which is not where Freddy was killed. It's not where Freddy killed anyone. It's not where an assault happened. It simply seems to stem from Nancy in the first film, possibly the glove being kept in the furnace. And it's fascinating to me that this house plays such an important role through these three films, even just kind of tangentially. And I think in part it's to do with there's a kind of iconic nature to the house. It's, you know, this beautiful kind of Puritan architecture. And it kind of mirrors Freddy's sweater with the red and the green. And there's this strange purity to it. There's this beautiful lawn. There are all these things. But within it, what is encased in it is horror. And they refer to something in the second film like, oh, you're living in the house where the girl had to have bars put on her windows.
Right.
She was locked in. So Nancy's kind of Orwellian nightmare of being locked in her own home is kind of fed into Nancy's family being unable to pack up her room properly. Like, Jesus Christ, take the journal with you.
Right. But that is the thread that connects the dots, I guess. You know, Jesse is locked into his own home. I can praise the film on those merits, but that's not to say that the pool scene isn't...
Oh, the pool scene's rough.
It's a cringe.
And I think Robert Englund is a good actor.
Yes.
And I think he is a great Freddy. We can talk a little bit more about this when we get to the next film. His biggest obstacle is that he is a small man.
Yeah.
He's a wee fella. I say this as someone, and I'm 5'10", so many people are wee to me. It's something they call out in the Never Sleep Again doc, but once he's out in the pool scene, he's just like a small guy, just kind of like playing tag with a bunch of teens.
Well, A, he doesn't belong in the real world, and B, like when you have him running around against regular-sized people, he looks ridiculous. He looks preposterous.
Yeah.
There are problems with this film, but it's a very important horror film.
Yeah. And it's fun. Have fun with it.
Exactly.
If you're not, then there's no helping you.
And I do feel like that's kind of Nightmare on Elm Street's trajectory. Like, we're going to get into number three next, but, like, the first film was very, very dark, very, very much a horror film, very scary and this and that. The second one is very playful and very tongue-in-cheek. Mm-hmm. And then we arrive in 1987 at Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, and it's got its own story.
Maybe tonight you'll be gone.
Razors on his right hand. Man of my dreams. He's real, isn't he? He's real. Let go of him, you bastard.
Thank you.
Several years after the events of the first film, there's an epidemic of teen suicides. A young girl, Kristen, begins dreaming of Freddy, causing what appears to be a suicide attempt, and she is incarcerated in the Weston Hospital, where she and several other teens are experiencing Freddy taking over their dreams. Nancy Thompson begins working at the hospital and realizes what's going on, that these teens are the last of the Elm Street children, and that Kristen can pull others into her dreams. One of the therapists, Neil, keeps encountering a mysterious nun who knows more about Freddy than anyone else and tells him that Freddy must be laid to rest in consecrated ground. They enlist Nancy's father, Lieutenant Thompson, to help find the bones. He dies in a struggle with the reanimated skeleton of Freddy, and Nancy, Kristen, and the rest of the group enter their dreams to fight Freddy and to get their friend Joey back, who's been trapped in the dream world. Freddy attacks and kills all of them except Nancy, Kristen, Kincaid, and Joey. Nancy's father appears in a dream to tell her he's crossing over and that he loves her. But that's revealed to be Freddy, who kills Nancy. Freddy's bones are laid to rest, and Nancy rises once more to stab Freddy in the dream with his own glove, seemingly killing him.
Seemingly.
Dun, dun, dun!
That's what happens.
That is what happens. This was a weird synopsis to put together.
Because it belies what a fucking party this movie is. And Rue Morgue screened it for Cine Macabre within the last year, and it's just such a crowd pleaser. It is so much fun to watch. Everybody's cheering, everybody's laughing. There's just so much going on, and it's so playful and fun, even though it deals with some very dark subjects. It harkens back to the original film. It pushes the film forward. It's really everything you want in a sequel, as far as I'm concerned.
I think so. And, you know, Dream Warriors, which is what the kids kind of call themselves in the end, I hold a special place in my heart, Andrea, because of you.
Why is that?
Because when you and I were first becoming friends before we started this podcast, Rue Morgue did a Cine Macabre during Toronto Fan Expo in the summer at the Toronto Underground Theater, which is now closed. Mm-hmm. Rue Morgue screened Cine Macabre. This is before Andrea was working with Rue Morgue. You were just buddies with them, and you invited me to the screening. And I went, and you were very busy and popular, so I just kind of sat on my own and was, like, watching it. I was like, yeah, this is fun. The whole crowd's really into it. And Robert Englund was there because he was there for Fan Expo.
Oh, yes. Okay, so that was the Festival of Fear screening.
Yeah, it was the Festival of Fear screening. And I was really enjoying it. And he came out, and he did a Q&A, and he was really energetic and talkative. And he was so energetic and talkative that I actually left before he finished. Not because I was bored or he said something dumb or anything like that. It was just because he kept going and I was so tired. But holy shit, that man has stories for days. He clearly relishes what it is to be Freddy Krueger. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what you start to see in Dream Warriors is not only this amazing kind of Breakfast Club-like camaraderie among the heroes of the film, but also Freddy kind of taking what we will think of as his final form.
Right.
And so to me, that was just kind of a great introduction to Robert Englund, Mr. Krueger himself, and God, he could just talk forever and be super interesting and funny.
Oh, yeah. He's.
But, oh, boy.
I remember that Festival of Fear. I remember attending his Q&A, and it's a Q&A in name only because it's a one-man show.
Oh, yeah.
If you were moderating a Q&A with Robert Englund, you are wallpaper. You are just setting the stage, winding him up, and watching him go. And Bruce Campbell is the same way. Just like, these are veterans of the convention circuit. They've answered all the questions 100,000 times to the point where they actually have a monologue that kind of like it answers everything you need to know. It's interesting. It's funny. They've got it down to an act.
Dare I say an art?
Sure. And I love how Never Sleep Again, once again, it really gives Robert Englund some room to explain his hand in creating Freddy Krueger, in the posture, in the fact that, yeah, I might be small, but, you know, like I can be sinister by ramping it up to 11. The glove is heavy, and so I dropped this shoulder, and like I had this stance, and I had this posture. And indeed, people who made subsequent Nightmare on Elm Street films, there is no Freddy without Robert Englund. There really isn't. And I think that was, again, a big problem with the remake.
Yes.
But yeah, going back to that article you shared about how the third of a franchise often goes back to the original and just blows it up to 15. And that's 100% the case with A Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
Well, and they talk about that in Never Sleep Again, is they felt that Nightmare on Elm Street 2 was kind of a derivation from the original. So they wanted to get back to it. And they asked Wes Craven to be involved.
Uh-huh.
And he and his writing partner came up with a concept and a draft of the script, which from what they show in Never Sleep Again seems quite dark. Like,
yes.
Freddy calling someone a cunt.
Yeah.
And so they seemingly, from what I understand, kept the original premise,
mm-hmm.
and just kind of did a gloss on it, did a kind of more digestible version of it. And so that is Chuck Russell, who directed the film,
mm-hmm.
and some guy named Frank Darabont.
Oh, that guy.
Maybe he's done something else.
Maybe.
But they kind of came on and made it almost like a more, again, as I mentioned, like a Breakfast Club-like version of the original film.
Right, which is totally emblematic of the 80s, which we're going to talk about it a little bit. This is a gang of friends you want to cheer for. They're not at all disposable teens. These are teens that you care about, and they all kind of have their own histories and their own foibles and their own weaknesses that if you can't relate to all of them, you can relate to at least one or two. And then, you know, like there's just the bombast of the 80s is so present in this film. It's present in the heavy metal soundtrack featuring Dokken. And then it brings Nancy back. So like I feel like the threads are really neatly tied in a bow in this film, in that you've got a conclusion to Nancy's narrative arc that doesn't compromise her character in any way. You've got the return of her father, who actually gets some redemption, an origin story that doesn't disappoint. What the fuck is that?
Holy crap.
I love it.
And that's something I actually feel like I remember hearing about before I ever saw the movies. Like, that was, I feel like, on a playground.
It's one of those things that when I rewatched the original film, I'm like, they're not talking about pedophilia. They're not talking about a bastard son of 100 maniacs.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that comes in later. That's right. But it works so well that it kind of bleeds in backwards somehow.
And I think this film, as Andrea already has kind of alluded to, deals with some really heavy topics.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, it kind of gets glossed over because so many of the effects in this film are incredible.
Incredible. The Freddy Big Snake biting Patricia Arquette. That looks amazing. That was practically done. A lot of practical effects, once
again.
Well,
there's no CGI back then.
Not at all?
No.
Well, what about when John Saxon comes back and he's kind of misty?
Yeah, but that's animation.
Oh.
Slightly different.
Okay, all right.
Slightly. But the image that kind of sticks with me is early on in the film, in Kristen's kind of first big nightmare, which she's running through 1428 Elm Street.
Mm-hmm.
And she walks into the, or she runs into the room, rather, and it's these bodies hanging.
Yeah.
And it's to kind of hint at the suicides that are mentioned throughout the film.
Mm-hmm.
And this is incredibly important to the time.
Yeah.
Again, Dream Warriors came out in 87, and there was a real panic in the mid-80s about teen suicide. There was a report that came out from the Center of Disease Control about the rise of suicide rates in teens especially, but kind of overall. And there are a lot of things that tackled teen suicide in popular culture. There were TV movies and, like, you know, very special episodes, but there were films such as Hear Me Cry, Silence of the Heart, and Surviving that were all very kind of maudlin looks about what happens when you kill yourself. And a little similarly to what's happened recently with the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why.
Mm.
And there was a panic when these films came out as they were trying to tackle the topic of teen suicide, but they also kind of romanticized it.
Mm.
And they were worried that other teens were looking at it saying, wow, look at all the attention these kids are getting after their death and all of the sympathy. And why don't I just do that? And then one of maybe my favorite films ever?
Oh?
A film called Heathers.
Oh, that.
I really love that film. And so that kind of recently had an anniversary, I think 30 some odd years old.
Boop.
And the writer of the screenwriter, Daniel Waters, said to Entertainment Weekly that he felt that there were so many teen suicide specials that it made it look attractive because of the attention. And with Heathers, even though no one actually commits suicide, in it, maybe except JD, and that can be arguable, but he kind of wanted to satirize it.
Yeah.
And make it seem silly and different and just like, this isn't actually something to worry yourself about. So I think for these kids in the hospital, they don't all realize that they're the Elm Street kids.
No, they don't seem to make that connection, do they? It's almost like the Elm Street kids has kind of transcended a geographic place and become more of a conceptual generational thing.
Yeah.
Children of Freddy are children of the 80s, children of this MTV generation where everything is so intense and superficial and also like kind of like unidirectional. Like when you look at media now, everyone has a voice. You have a ticket right to creators. You can become internet famous. That's a thing. In the 80s, it was just like one way MTV coming right at you. And so the 80s saw a spike in medicalizing a lot of teenage mania. And that had to do with like a lot of conditions suddenly got recognition, such as anorexia, bulimia. These were a byproduct of an obsession with dieting and appearances where kids were kind of tasked with all this and didn't really have a means to discuss with one another about it, to critique it, to challenge it. They just had to internalize it and deal with it. And whether that was a suicide attempt, self-harm, drug abuse, becoming really aggressive, like all of these are manifested in these hospitalized kids.
Yeah. It's strange. When I was watching this film, and every time I've kind of watched it in the last few years, I keep thinking back to an ex-partner of mine, and he was a very, like, easygoing guy, not too much fussed him or anything. And I wound up going back to his family's cottage at one point while we were dating. And he had a great, or still has, as far as I know, a great relationship with his parents. Mm-hmm. And they're lovely, lovely people. And one night after a couple beers, he just laid into his dad.
Oh.
It was just me, his dad, and him. And he laid into his dad about why they put him on Ritalin.
Awkward.
It was super awkward. And his dad was in shock. His dad was just in like, I don't know. And I remember stepping in, having some kind of sense of mind to say, you know, sir, I think you probably did what you thought was best for your son at this point. Mm-hmm. I'm sure some doctor told you, he needs to be on something. You should put him on this.
Yeah.
And you thought what you were doing was the best for him.
Uh-huh.
So maybe, honey, partner, let's take it down a couple notches.
Yeah.
And eventually they did. And then they were all very, like, white male about it and didn't talk about it the next day.
Okay. But
I remember that outburst so clearly.
Right.
So clearly after so many homemade beers. Because it was this anger about some part of his childhood, some part of his adolescence being taken away from him because he was medicated.
That's right.
And to me, that's what so much of this film speaks to.
That's so much what this franchise speaks to. Fundamentally, Nightmare on Elm Street is about kids struggling with something that their parents don't want to understand, but their parents are responsible for. And so they're dealing with not only this bodily threat, but the terror of not being believed again and again and again. And whether it's in the house and your parents put bars on the windows, or you're institutionalized and you're being literally sedated and put in a position of threat, this is what we have here. And so Nancy gets her full comeuppance by coming around and being like, I believe you. I'm going to stick up for you. I'm going to be the hero that I wish I had.
It's interesting to me that the kind of relationship between her and Neil, the other doctor.
I heard that they were romantically linked in Wes Craven's original version, which was subsequently toned down.
Yeah, no, they were totally involved. They were totally fucking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, fucking.
Oh, yeah. They were
fucking.
Like boyfriend, girlfriend.
Oh, so fucking.
Yeah. They were, I mean, as someone who's about to be married.
Yes, you can't speak with such crude tongue.
I don't know. But no, they had a very intense, shall we say, relationship.
Well, fuck that. I'm okay with it being gone because, you know, as we often talk about in this podcast, you don't need romantic intrigue for a female character to exist and be important.
But I found it was interesting how much she wanted him to believe.
She really did.
And for him to understand.
He did. Yeah, he did, didn't he?
It took a ghost nun to convince him.
I found it really interesting that she was so willing to take these drastic, risky measures to protect them outside of this system. And we talk about big P patriarchy. Well, now I'm going to talk about big S system, because It's institutionalized in a hospital. It's medicalized. It's, you know, science is what we know and science is true. And if science is saying that someone can't kill you in your dreams, then science is correct and you are wrong. And so I think in the original film for the judicial system, which everyone had such faith in at the time to have failed them and caused this big problem, it's that same thing again. And you've got Nancy taking the law into her own hands, much in the same way her parents did, but it goes better for her.
Well, I've never rooted for a character to align themselves more with Big Pharma than in this film. Because I was like, she has a drug and it seems to work just fine for her.
Which is really important, I think, because insofar as this film does critique the medicalization of teenage suicidal depression, this and that and the other thing, she has found a medication that works for her.
Yeah.
And even though, like, oh, what do you mean you can't dream? That's not – it works for me, motherfucker. Try to tell me otherwise. Mm-hmm. Like, I know the truth. And that I think there's something really important in seeing a woman stand up for that.
Well, and just to see anyone stand up for a kind of treatment that works for them.
That's right.
I know very few people in my life who are not on some form of medication.
Mm-hmm. No, it's
that
true.
That helps them. That yep. truly helps them and helps them live a better life.
Yep.
And so I...
And maybe still grappling with some stigma, even in this day and age.
Yeah, absolutely.
Less and less, I like to say, but...
Now, there was something that when I was rewatching Never Sleep Again, mm-hmm. and they were talking about this. This was the section of the Dream Warriors film. And Wes Craven mentioned something... So briefly, it's so brief. It's, you know, he's talking about, you know, I wanted to talk about these kids and that they were being taken away to this kind of like forced institutionalization or something like that. And the film flashes up for like half a second, seemingly an ad. And I was like, okay, that's something.
Oh, so, yeah, yeah.
Again, cut to me in another Googling montage.
Had a girl.
And I think what Wes Craven was referring to is something called the troubled teen industry.
Uh-huh.
Now, Andrea,
yes.
you and I are probably most familiar with it during sick days or some good after-school watching with Maury when they would take those awful teens away.
Send them to boot camp.
Send them to boot camp.
Scare them straight.
Put them in the wilderness for 48 hours, whatever the fuck. And exactly, scare them straight. Now, essentially what this industry was, it promised itself as something that when a parent or a guardian could no longer manage an adolescent, they could be taken to some kind of forced boarding school.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this troubled teen industry began in the 1980s during Reagan's war on drugs. And this kind of institutionalization was a pseudo drug rehab, and it was most popularized by an institution called Straight Inc. And this ran in popularity from 1976 to 1993, and its focus was on quote-unquote clients aged 13 to 20, and approximately 10,000 teens went through that specific program.
Wow.
There are, you can, we'll link a couple of things in the show notes about this, but there are truly terrifying articles about the kinds of abuse, systematic abuse that happened to these kids while under their care. And even though people like Reagan and George Bush, the president after Reagan, praised it, these abuse claims eventually were what brought it down. But unfortunately, you know, these kind of ideas never really die. So the practitioners, the people involved with it, splintered and created kind of subset groups. So people can still put their kids in these kinds of institutions.
Oh, for sure.
Or these kinds of programs. And it's so scary because there would be systematic abuse. And part of what the program would say to these parents who, by and large, were putting their kids into these programs thinking they were doing something really good for them, to not believe their children's claims.
Yeah.
To say, your kid may say some crazy-ass shit to get out of it, but don't believe them.
Yeah. It's part of the sickness.
And it that just... Even though in Dream Warriors, it's maybe not exactly the same thing because it is a hospital. Despite all the good between Nancy and Neil and what they're trying to do, there is so much corruption and grossness. Like the orderly who's telling Taryn that they can have their night in heaven because he has access to all of the meds.
Yeah.
Like there is so much wrong.
corruption unchecked and teenagers unlistened to and left to their own devices. And in that case, you know, they band up. And this was something that you see throughout the 1980s, that the coming of age film, the end of innocence film, was a big thing in the 80s. And once again, that's John Hughes films, that's Stand By Me, The Goonies. It's something that we're seeing a lot of homage to lately with the 80s revival. We're seeing that in Stranger Things, revisiting It, Summer of 84, where these teenagers have the idea that the only ones they can rely on are each other, to believe them because the parents are the enemy, the institutions are the enemy. Nobody understands exactly what it's like to be them. And I think, you know, my adolescence wasn't exactly easy, but the 80s were a really, really rough time for adolescents.
There is another kind of interesting thing that I think separates Nightmare on Elm Street from the rest of, let's say, the big slashers. Mm-hmm. And it's that death already exists within these films. The killer is undead. Mm-hmm. And you know, obviously, Michael Myers comes back, Jason Voorhees, they all fucking come back. Mm-hmm. But Freddy starts out the series as dead.
Right.
And I think a lot of the fear and a lot of the panic that we kind of start to see within this film in particular and gets explored further on in the rest of the series is that even after Freddy gets you, mm-hmm. that's not the end.
Right.
That the afterlife is a terrifying place.
Yeah.
The afterlife is a scary place if he gets you.
Right. This was the first film that kind of depicted him as collecting souls, mm-hmm. as kind of a reaper where you wind up, you know, part of his breastplate.
Pizza. I'm jumping ahead. But no, it's something that I found very interesting to kind of, you know, it's not like, oh, I've just got to run from Jason, and if I don't make it, okay, well, at least it all goes dark.
Right.
There is something more, and there is something more painful than what I currently know.
Uh-huh.
So I think that kind of leads into a little bit of the notion of, again, something that Chuck Russell, the director of this film, brings up in Never Sleep Again, where he talks about, you know, if Nightmare on Elm Street 2 was the gay horror film, then this is the Christian Elm Street.
Right.
It's so funny because I was thinking of, like, the last nun I saw in a horror movie was, like, Valak in The Nun.
I still haven't seen that.
You're fine. And it's so strange to me because I really struggle with this in a lot of horror films and particularly in a lot of slasher films because I love them, but I also don't believe in capital P patriarchy or the moral majority or anything like that. And I think these films, by default, tend to gravitate towards a kind of moral majority Christian sentiment. And that's not to say all Christianity is bad. There is a lot of amazing Christians who do incredible work in the world. But this kind of creepy moral majority section, I want nothing to do with. And when we put Freddy as, like, yes, he's the bastard of a thousand sons, but also the son of a nun, and it is the nun appearing to Neil, who's like, no, you need to bury him in consecrated ground, and that's what will kill him.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that tends to be a bit too easy. It tends to place A Nightmare on Elm Street less in its own mythology and within a bigger Christian mythology.
Hmm.
For instance, one of the reasons I really love the Ring film so much, both the Japanese and the American version, is because they have to deal with Samara on her own terms.
Mm-hmm.
They can't be like, wait, no, just bless that ground. Bless that well and she'll be gone.
Well, wait. In the Ring, the Naomi Watts character does have a belief that she can free her if she goes down there, and she believes that that will be the case, and it turns out to not at all be the case. And that's the same in Nightmare on Elm Street 3, isn't it? Where, like, yeah, move the bones to consecrated ground, but this film still ends with the same kind of stinger that Freddy is not dead, right?
Well, it's just the house turning on at the end.
Yeah. Which to me is enough of a, I don't know.
Totally. It's a
stinger. I just see this as yet another misguided attempt to vanquish Freddy, but he's still not dead yet. And furthermore, when I think of nuns, I tend to think of nuns as, I mean, they're almost analogous to the teenagers in this case. A lot of nuns of this day and era were women who were rejected by their households. Mm-hmm. They weren't necessarily brides of Christ by choice. They were maybe unwed mothers who were sent off to the convent. They were undesirables who were just kind of cloistered in this really oppressive regime. And so, I mean, I see what you're saying, but yeah, I don't see this mythology and this Christianization as anything different than Lisa kissing him or, Nancy saying that she doesn't believe in him and that being just as powerful.
Yeah, I think it just feeds into a bigger issue within the 80s.
Yeah.
Again, that moral majority, Christian conservative section of Christianity that creeps me out a bit. But what I find is actually kind of a subtle deviance from that is the reappearance of Lieutenant Thompson or John Saxon within the dreamscape. And, you know, he says, he's actually kind of creepy when he shows up. He's like, ah, honey, I'm just crossing over.
I love you so much.
Yeah. And there is something about that, which is like in that dream moment in his appearance as like himself.
Yeah.
He is that kind of Reagan promise of you can be lost, but then you're found again. And he's cogent and he's saying exactly all of the right things to Nancy. He's saying, I'm sorry, I failed you, but I love you and everything's going to be okay. And then he fucking stabs her as Freddy.
Right.
And so I find that to be a very interesting parallel.
Yeah, if anything, I think it's a subversion of capital C Christianity where it's, you know, I'm off to heaven. Oh, wait, no, I'm not. Heaven doesn't exist and fuck you. Like, it just kind of tears all that down.
Or even that just kind of two-facedness.
Yeah.
Like, I'm Christian to some people, but not to others.
Okay.
And so I think Freddy is just this thing that every film struggles to contain.
Yeah, and none of them can.
None of them can. Till the master comes back.
Well, and then there are some other problems, but I love how he's slippery. I love how I found the Christian, you know, laying his bones to rest. It was as plausible as any of the solutions that we had heard before. And so the fact that nothing works, but they keep trying these different things and they keep, you know, if anything, the Christian angle was perhaps the more supernatural of all the approaches to vanquish Freddy. I like that. All this really speaks to the amorphous nature of Freddy Krueger, and part of the reason that he is so popular and so persistent in popular culture is because he defies all of these tropes. He can be in a straight-up horror movie, he can be in an 80s party movie, he can be in a queer possession movie and still kind of come out on top and, you know, like dodge the good guy and persist.
Yeah, he's a really amazing creation of some of our most unrealized fears because he exists in our dreamscape, because he exists in a place that is kind of tangential. He's not something you can touch. He's not tactile. He's not confined to a camp. He's not confined to a mental institution. He's present. He's present within our psyches. He is that collective unconscious which could rear its ugly head. And as the protagonists of these films see again and again, is that he will fucking come back. And I think one of the interesting things about Nightmare on Elm Street as a franchise is how many returning characters they are.
Yeah.
Even if it's not always the returning actor, you will have returning characters struggling and failing against this character, against Freddy and everything that he can do. Because ultimately, what I think Freddy represents is all of the things that we deny, all of the things that we are too scared or unable to confront.
Yeah, that we repress. And that is, that's fundamental. That's horror 101.
Yeah.
And this film is, you know, New Line is the house that Freddy built. It's one of those, we talked about this with Halloween, is that it's the indie movie that could. It was the perfect storm, the perfect confluence of ambition and talent and creativity that just blew up to be this huge worldwide cultural phenomenon. And we'll get into that more with our next episode. This episode was focusing on like the foundational aspects of the franchise, but this franchise just goes everywhere. And Alex and I have been going back and forth with like, how in the flying fuck are we going to break this huge franchise off into just two episodes? Do we need a third episode? Like, how do we section them out?
But we're not doing a third episode.
No.
We're going to contain this to two.
We're going to stick this to two. And we decided to do these first three because I feel like they are foundational to the story, to the character of Freddy. But for next episode, we are going to broaden our stance a bit. We're not going to give quite as much equal weight to further installments in the franchise because this shit gets meta, and that's important and really interesting.
Yeah. So for the next episode, we'll talk about 4, 5, 6. We'll play deep dive on New Nightmare, and we're definitely going to talk about Freddy versus Jason. So if you want to stay up to date on your homework, get those A pluses. Watch the rest of the series.
Watch them all. We're watching them all.
Yeah.
It's not shitty homework at all.
I hope not. We're not making you watch the remake, so.
No.
I will mention the remake in certain regards, but you don't have to watch it.
I kind of want to rewatch it.
Oh, good luck.
I know I hated it, but like sometimes when I hate stuff, I just kind of get this mental block. I saw it in the theater, so I know I finished it.
Yeah.
And I also know that the guy who played Freddy, what the fuck?
Jackie Earl Haley.
No, he auditioned to be the original Freddy, and he is a huge horror fan and a huge fan of the franchise.
He
and
is
so
an incredible actor.
My heart kind of breaks for him. When I bash the remake, I feel a twinge of guilt.
I am a big fan of Jackie Earl Haley, and I was so excited to see him do Freddy, and then he was just in this CGI nightmare.
Robert Englund is an impossible act to follow.
Yeah.
Not a tough act, an impossible act to follow.
If you want to see Jackie Earl Haley's take on Freddy Krueger, watch a little film called Little Children.
Oh.
Yep.
He plays a pedophile?
Yep.
Oh.
Yeah, there you go. Watch that film. It's actually a pretty good film.
But you don't have to. It's not homework.
No, it's not homework. But just, you know.
Do your homework, because we're coming upon May, and part two is coming at you.
So get some fucking sleep, guys.
Or never sleep again, whatever the case may be. Before we go, just a quick reminder that our merch is currently on sale. We mentioned it last episode. It's still up for a little while yet, but for a limited time, as always, our Class of 2019 artwork is available in t-shirt form, but also tote bags.
Tote bags!
Tote bags!
Gonna take plastic bags no more.
Amazing.
Thank you.
So be sure to pick those up. Book your trip to Salem if you haven't already.
October 5th. We're going to be there.
We're seeing people tweeting about having booked. I'm so excited.
I'm so excited. So I think I've heard that possibly Mark Patton will be there that weekend.
Guys.
I've heard that Rachel True will be there that
guys,
weekend.
Guys, you have to come.
And we don't, like, charge you to hang out with us. Like other podcasts.
No, we charge you for photos.
Yeah.
Or we're starting?
No.
This year?
No.
Come on.
Never.
Fine.
Just pay us in cookies.
Tim Tams.
So yeah, we've got some really cool stuff coming up, more great episodes. I'm so excited to wrap up this franchise because I have a lot of feelings about the end of this franchise.
Okay.
So many.
And we're going to go there, so stay tuned. And until then...
Office hours are closed.
Dream, 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 when I want you in my arms, when I want you, and all your charms, whenever I want you, all I have to do is dream.
Dream.